Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for organizing conference on this very important topic. It feels very special to be standing here in the Peace Palace and, of course, being Ukrainian and talking about the situation in Ukraine. 10 years ago, when I developed my interest in international criminal law, I could never imagine that 10 years later I would be an associate professor, one thing, and then secondly, I will be standing at the conference and talking about the situation in my home country. So I have very personal interest in the subject as well. There is a lot to say about the situation in Ukraine, and I have only 15 minutes, and I don't know how well acquainted you are with the situation in Ukraine, so I will make a brief recap of the conflict and its phases, because it's very complex. It covers Maidan crimes, it covers the annexation of Crimea, MH17, Eastern Ukraine, and I'm afraid we cannot cover everything in 15 minutes. Then I will focus on the two declarations that have been lodged by Ukraine, accepting the ad hoc jurisdiction of the ICC, and will conclude with some challenges and way forward. I published two articles on the situation in Ukraine, it's around 90 pages, so I'm sure that I'm not going to be able to squeeze in all my arguments in 15 minutes. But for those of you who are interested, I wrote a more general piece that was published last year with the Vanderbilt Journal of Transnational Law. And then I look at the ICC prosecutor's interpretation of crimes against humanity in relation to the Maidan events. And the article was just published a few months ago with the Boston University International Law Journal. These two articles are open access, so you can just Google it. And if you're interested to know more about the situation, you're going to be able to find a more in-depth analysis. So first of all, just a few words about what has happened in Ukraine. So political tensions started when the former president Yanukovych refused to sign a deal and close the ties with the European Union. Then the pro-European protesters occupied the central square, and in the very beginning it was a very peaceful protest that turned violent. You had university students that wanted a better democratic future for their country that were protesting against the corrupt government. To wrap it up, that the violence took place from December to February 2014. There was a typo here. And then at the peak of violence in February 2014, around between 75 to 100 protesters were killed by law enforcement agencies. Who were authorized to use violence by the former government of Ukraine. And hundreds of people were injured. But in fact, it's very difficult to know the exact number of casualties because many people who were injured, they did not want to be treated in the governmental hospitals. So they were treated in the makeshift hospitals that were set up at the Maidan and at volunteer hospitals. So actually, until now, we still don't know the entire number of casualties. But with respect to death, one can say that not more than 100 people died. So this is the first phase of the conflict. The former president, of course, tried to broker a deal with the opposition, which was rejected by the general public, claiming that he feared for his life. He left Ukraine, and he is currently in Russia. Afterwards, we have secessionist movements in Crimea, and as you know, there was a sham referendum that was held in Crimea, where the majority of the Crimean population expressed their will to become part of Russia, which was done, and which is, as well, there was the law passed by the Russian parliament on the reunification of Crimea with its historical homeland. As you know, Russia has very strategic interest in Crimea, and it was many times that Putin himself said that it was a major mistake that Nikita Khrushchev gifted Crimea to the Ukrainian Socialist Republic. So if some of you saw documentary Crimea Way Back Home, you can see the first official interview of President Putin, who says that the historical mistake has been remedied when Crimea was reunited again with Russia. So that's the second phase of the conflict. Then we have the third phase of the conflict, which is Eastern Ukraine. So when Crimea was annexed, similar secessionist movement were taking place in Eastern Ukraine. There were two self-proclaimed republics. Donetsk People's Republic and Lugansk People's Republic that as well expressed their wish to secede from Ukraine. Then the Ukrainian government started the anti-terrorist operation. I would like to say that Ukrainian government does not recognize what's happening on the territory of Eastern Ukraine as an armed conflict, but they treat it as the anti-terrorist operation. And then, as you know, on 17th July 2014, the MH17 was shot down over the territory of Ukraine. And it was actually for the very first time that the RCRC declared that the conflict was governed by the rules of international humanitarian law and we are in the presence of a non-international armed conflict. The conflict is still ongoing, and right now the ICC prosecutor is looking at was the conflict has transformed from non-international to international armed conflict. So that was very brief. Ukraine signed but did not ratify the Rome Statute. So the ratification of the Rome Statute was stalled in 2001 by the decision of the Constitutional Court of Ukraine that said that the Rome Statute principle of complementarity was contrary to the Constitution of Ukraine. There were attempts to ratify the Rome Statute in 2008-2014, but they failed at the time. So after the Maidan protest, the Ukrainian government lodged a declaration to the ICC accepting the ad hoc jurisdiction of the court, only with respect to the Maidan crimes, only with respect to the crimes committed between November and February 2014. In September 2015, Ukraine submitted another declaration that recognized the jurisdiction of the court over the alleged crimes committed in Crimea and Eastern Ukraine. In 2016, Ukraine passed the law amending the Constitution of Ukraine, recognizing the jurisdiction of the ICC. But it's very peculiar that this provision on the recognition of the ICC jurisdiction will only enter into force in 2019. So I think that what the Ukrainian government was trying to say, okay, well, the conflict is going on right now, let's wait 3 years and we'll ratify the Rome Statute and then the Ukrainian government and the Ukrainian forces will not be prosecuted for the crimes taking place in Eastern Ukraine. But the ICC prosecutor has the jurisdiction right now, any case, over the all sides of the conflict, given a very openly formulated the clause in the second declaration, accepting the jurisdiction of the court. So what are the problems with the declaration? First of all, does the declaration override the earlier ruling of the Constitutional Court of Ukraine? I don't think that the ICC has ever faced such complex situation where such an interesting, one can say, in interesting relationship between the constitutional and international law. So at the time that when Ukraine lodged a declaration to the ICC, the ruling of the Constitutional Court of Ukraine was still valid. So was the government entitled to do that? Secondly, the second constitutional problem, who signed the declaration? Was the declaration duly signed? As you know, according to the Constitution of Ukraine, such declarations should be signed by the President of Ukraine. President of Ukraine fled to Russia. Then the head of parliament, who acted as ex officio head of state, signed the declaration. And if you were following Russian media, they were saying that the declaration lodged by Ukraine to the ICC is in fact illegal because the head of parliament acting ex officio was not entitled to sign this declaration. So you have two major constitutional law issues, and I'm not sure whether the ICC prosecutor or potentially the pretrial chamber will look at those. Then in the first declaration, Ukraine tried to highlight its grievances and was actually naming suspects. So Ukraine said the president of former president of Ukraine, including a number of high-ranking senior officials, committed crimes against humanity. As you know, the state which is subscribing to the jurisdiction of the ICC cannot name the suspects. It's the ICC prosecutor who should decide who are the suspects at the later stage of proceedings. So Fatou Bensouda took 1.5 years to look at the first declaration. And what she concluded that there is limited information at this stage to support the conclusion that the alleged attack carried out in the context of the Maidan protest was either widespread or systematic. So turning to her definition of widespread, she said that killing 7,500 people and injuring, 700 is not enough to qualify under the widespread element of crimes against humanity. I, in my research, I looked at the number of casualties in the situation in Kenya and Ivory Coast, and here I can see that, yes, the number of casualties in the situation in Kenya and Ivory Coast was higher, and the crimes were more geographically spread out, which may explain the ICC prosecutor's decision with respect to her evaluation of Ukrainian events. But I argue in my article that in fact the systematic requirement was satisfied, and the decision of the ICC prosecutor stems from the lack of clarity in international criminal law how the systematic requirement should be applied on a stand-alone basis and how it interacts with the element of a state or organizational policy. And here I give a few examples in my article. We don't have time to go through it, but here I argue that there were another elements that show the systematic requirement of the attack, and that was the organized and regular pattern of behavior by Ukrainian law enforcement agencies, repeated and continuous commission of crimes from December to February, implications of high-level officials, including the former president of Ukraine and former ministers, and as well as condemnation of crimes by senior but top political leadership and failure to punish the responsible ones. So for me, it's quite strange that the ICC prosecutor did not find that the Maidan crimes satisfied the systematic requirement. So this is what I have to say about the first declaration. So here is the second declaration. We have the first similar constitutional law issues, but then the major problem with the second declaration is the qualification of an armed conflict. So the ICC prosecutor already said that we have international armed conflict on the territory of Crimea, but with respect to eastern Ukraine, it's a bit more complicated because it's not because there are allegations of Russia's providing support, manpower, financing, equipment to the rebel groups in eastern Ukraine, but it's not clear yet whether that level of support satisfies the effective control test. So at the moment, the ICC prosecutor is looking whether Russia's support qualifies under the, not the effective, excuse me, under the overall control test. And then we have as well MH17, which is really, really tricky. And it's quite interesting that the Ukrainian government, when they submitted the second declaration, they tried deliberately to exclude MH17 incident from the prospective prosecution in the ICC. They said that the second declaration only applied with respect to Ukrainians who were subject to crimes taking place in eastern Ukraine. So basically, as you know, the majority of those who died were Dutch nationals and Australian. So basically, Ukraine was trying to put some jurisdictional limitations, which I argue as well is illegal, and the ICC prosecutor is able to look at the MH17 incident and as well is able to address the responsibility of all parties for the conflict, because Ukraine of course uses the declaration to highlight its grievances over the situation and says that the Russia has committed an act of aggression against the Ukraine, and Russian nationals and top politicians should be responsible for what has been happening in Crimea and eastern Ukraine. The problem in Ukraine that the members of Ukrainian armed forces are treated as heroes. This is something that Andrew Cayley said in the morning. So when there is the subject of the responsibility of Ukrainian armed forces for the crimes committed in eastern Ukraine, it's a very sensitive subject. And of course, nobody wants to see the prosecution of another side of the conflict in the ICC. Why national courts are not a viable option? So far there were very few cases with respect to the Maidan crimes. Very few low-ranking perpetrators were tried in Ukrainian courts. So far as I know, and I spoke earlier during the lunch break with Vladimir Tachilovsky, there is only maybe one case that has been finalized in Ukrainian court. Basically, Ukrainian courts do not do anything to prosecute these crimes. The strategy of the Ukrainian government is to show to the entire world that we are suffering, let the ICC sort out our problems, which I think is very sad, and it's actually a different position to what has been discussed with respect to Colombia and Kenya, where national authorities want to exercise the jurisdiction over the crimes. Ukrainians do not want to exercise jurisdiction. They want the International Criminal Court to sort out their problems, collect the evidence and convict those responsible of the crimes. So I think on the subject of the quality control, what's going to be good if the ICC prosecutor were doing more outreach work in Ukraine, saying, okay, well, if the case moves forward in the ICC, that only top level perpetrators will be prosecuted. Low-ranking perpetrators should be prosecuted at the national level. And hopefully this would have a catalyzing effect on the national prosecution in Ukraine. The ICC is quite lucky because ICC has access to evidence. And Ukrainian authorities are willing to cooperate with the court. But Ukrainian authorities are willing to cooperate, but they're not willing to provide high-quality evidence. So basically what's being done, that you have the general prosecutor office saying, okay, we submitted some kind of evidence to the International Criminal Court, but they're not doing proper work in collecting and analyzing this evidence. The spokesperson from the General Prosecutor Office said they have one person in the General Prosecutor's Office in Ukraine dealing with the analysis of evidence with relation to the Maidan crimes. Given the high priority of the case for Ukrainian authorities, this is actually quite sad that the General Prosecutor's Office is not prioritizing this kind of cases. Nothing has been done with respect to the prosecution of crimes in Crimea, for obvious reasons. Ukraine has no control over this piece of territory, and nothing has been done with respect to the prosecution of cases in eastern Ukraine. So my final argument is that Ukraine has to stop playing political games and ratify the Rome Statute, but then the ICC prosecutor should also be quite fast in dealing with the situation, because the conflict is still ongoing. It's getting worse and worse. And I think that the ICC prosecutor does not have this luxury, as in the case of Georgia, sitting for 7 years before coming up to some reasonable conclusion whether to move forward with the situation. So I think that given the importance of the situation, the ICC prosecutor has to decide what to do with the Maidan crimes, and also has to decide whether to proceed with the investigation of crimes in eastern Ukraine. But there will be, of course, there might be another legitimacy crisis if we have any outstanding warrants against Russian nationals that will never be surrendered to the ICC. Then the ICC would be left with the ghost cases that are hanging on the website of the court, but the very bleak prospects of these cases being prosecuted. Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.